The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericavariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
This program contains explicit content and subject matter which may be unsuitable for some listeners. Discretion is advised.
Sex Out Loud is sponsored by Lilo, award-winning designers of the world's best pleasure objects.
Smart, sexy, kinky, fun.
Welcome to Sex Out Loud with your host, sex educator, author, and filmmaker, Tristan Taramino. It's sex-positive radio like you've never heard before. Tristan talks about sexuality from every angle with leading authors, experts, artists, and icons. From sex education and sexual politics to BDSM and non-monogamy, nothing is off limits. So get ready to open your mind and expand your horizons. This is Sex Out Loud. And now here's your host, Tristan Taramino.
Welcome to Sex Out Loud. I have, as promised, as my guest today, Matilda Bernstein Sycamore. You may recall that she was scheduled to be on a few weeks ago, and we actually both got a cold that very day. She got very sick. I also got sick. And so we had to reschedule. So for all of you who've been waiting, she's here. I just want to make a few announcements before we begin. First of all, I've been telling you every week about these amazing free sex ed events at the Pleasure Chest, which is one of my fabulous sponsors. And let me tell you about what's coming up in LA at the store in West Hollywood on April 20th, How Cannabis Can Enhance Your Sex Life with Ashley Manta. I actually know Ashley. She's a peer of mine, and this is her passion in life. And of course, they're having it on 420. I'm sure you guys got that joke. So check that out. And then on 427, Suck It, Live It, Love It with Chris and Chelsea. It's a class all about oral sex, and you just got to love that title. I mean, it says kind of everything, right? Now, for New York on April 20th, Dominance and Submission, Hot Fiction, Hotter Facts with Molina Williams-Haas. Molina has been a guest on my show several times, including recently, and she is one of my favorite BDSM sex educators in the world, so you don't want to miss that if you're in New York. And then a week later, on April 27th, also in New York, Advanced Blowjobs with Dell. Okay, and I want to remind you that we've got a 24-hour voicemail line. So if you have questions, whether they're sex advice or relationship questions that you want for an Ask Tristan segment, or you have comments or questions about things you've heard on this show, give us a call anytime you want, 323-SEX-8266, 323-SEX-8266. Let me tell you about my guest. Matilda Bernstein Sycamore is a flaming queen dedicated to keeping the fire burning. She's the author of a memoir and two novels, and editor of 5 nonfiction anthologies. Her most recent title, The End of San Francisco, won a 2014 Lambda Literary Award. And her most recent anthology, Why Are Faggots So Afraid of Faggots? Flaming Challenges to Masculinity, Objectification, and the Desire to Conform was an American Library Association Stonewall Honor book. She recently finished a mesmerizing third novel, which we might get to hear about, and hopefully the right publisher will snap that up soon. Welcome to Sex Out Loud, Matilda.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Wow. So I don't know whether to begin with the fact that, like, you and I knew each other back in the day.
It's so true. I was thinking, we have not had a conversation this long in, what is that, like at least 15 years, right?
I mean, I maybe 12, 13, 15. Yeah. I mean, it was the 90s. It was like the Lower East Side. I feel like the last time I saw you was at Blue Stockings bookstore. Is that possible?
That's hilarious. Well, no, I did see you. You came to my reading for Nobody Passes in Hudson, right?
Oh, yes, I did. Okay, so the last time I saw each other was in Hudson.
That's true. That's true. Yes. We didn't get a chance to talk this long, to talk in depth. Yeah, but that was a great.
Yeah.
I love seeing you there. I remember being surprised because I didn't recognize you at first. I was like, who is this really smart person from the audience asking these great questions?
Yeah, you know me. So I thought before we dive into this book, we would, because your book is so much about like memories and also people, that we might share memories of each other first. So I'm going to start, okay?
Perfect.
Okay. So this is my memory of you. In New York, you were one of the most radical activists doing anti-assimilation work. You were fabulously dressed every single time I saw you. There was literally not a day when I saw you and was like, oh, well, she's phoning it in today. No, you always had amazing fashion. You were one of the first, most dedicated vegans I knew. Because you used to bring vegan food with you to all sorts of readings, meetings, events. Like we would be at the same queer stuff and you would always have vegan food with you. And I thought, wow, Matilda probably thinks I'm just not cool enough. That's what I thought. That was those. So those are my memories that like you were just, you were, wow, you were larger than life. And I was a little bit intimidated.
Oh, that's fascinating. I never realized you were intimidated because I know when I met you and I think, did we meet through D. Travers Scott? Is that how we met originally?
Oh, that might. Yeah, that might be. Absolutely. Yes.
And I remember you spoke. I probably spoke super fast. So if I thought you spoke super fast, I was like, oh, this is really fast. And that you were driven by sex and sexuality as lenses to both articulate and interrogate the larger world. And that you always had fascinating stories ranging, you know, both in terms of your personal history and also, you know, from a while back and also from, you know, current day in New York at that time. And I remember having really great hours-long conversations with you.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm excited for this one.
Okay, good. So the end of San Francisco is not linear. It's not traditional. It's a little sideways. You probably wouldn't have it any other way. But I want to hear about your writing process and when you exactly decided it wouldn't be, for lack of a better word here, straight.
Well, I never write in a linear way. I find that linear writing is dishonest. And I don't think our lives are that way. I don't think our brains work that way. And so if I'm going to be portraying something honest, then I want it to go in all directions at once. And so this book came about in a really interesting way. I was just writing. You know, I didn't have any intention at all. I didn't know it could be a book at all. And at a certain point, you know, I actually, in a way, this book, it did in a way start with a beginning, which was deciding to visit my father on his deathbed. He was dying of terminal cancer, and I hadn't spoken to him since 11 years before when I confronted him about sexually abusing me as a kid. And I decided to visit him, even though he never acknowledged anything, because I didn't want to realize, you know, years down the line, like, oh, I wish I had seen him, because there wouldn't be a possibility because he would be dead. So I went on this trip that was incredibly emotional and incredibly draining. But what happened when I saw him is, you know, everyone in, you know, was basically against me, everyone in the family, you know, in that interaction. But I felt so strong in being able to express my emotions, which was something I was never able to do as a kid. It wasn't possible because I had to survive. And the writing from that, even though it has nothing to do with San Francisco, and even though it's the beginning of the book, it happens after everything else that happens in the book. The writing in that book sort of opened up the possibility the writing in that moment, you know, of visiting him, opened up the possibility for me to think about all these other things. And when I sat down, the first time when I thought, oh, I have a manuscript of something, it was 1,200 pages. And it was basically everything I had written for about several years. And then what I did with that material, because I knew it wouldn't be 1,200 pages, but is I took it and I separated it thematically. So I would have, maybe I had about 150 pages about trying to regain a sense of hope in my own sexuality. And that became a chapter that's, I think, 12 pages. And then in the writing, of course, I ended up circling around all of my formative moments, you know, the places and people and feelings that had made and unmade me. And so the book followed, and I wanted to keep that structure even in the editing process, you know. And so it has this sort of elliptical structure while I'm circling around my formative moments, which end up being, you know, I sort of end up in the middle of the book, you know, in San Francisco, and circling around this idea of San Francisco as a refuge for radical queer visions in community building, you know, and the place that had formed me and allowed me to form my own politics, my own sexuality, my own intimacy, my own dreaming, and my own activism. And I wanted to interrogate where all of that had failed me. And so, in a way, the book is circling around these moments that have made and unmade me, and also the places where everything has failed me and let me down, in order, maybe, to imagine something else.
Mm. Well, there is so much in this book to talk about. We've got to take our first commercial break, because we need to keep the lights on, as they say, and hear from our great sponsors. So, everyone, stay with us. That was like just a little piece. It was like a little crumb of what's in this book, and hopefully we're going to get to a lot more. So don't go anywhere. More with Matilda Bernstein Sycamore when we return. Hey everyone, it's Tristan. Listen, there is nothing sexier than experience. Just ask the Pleasure Chest. As the oldest sex-positive boutique in America, this legendary establishment has made it their mission to provide sexual fulfillment to everyone, regardless of orientation, identity, or experience. With stores in New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago, as well as online, The Pleasure Chest wants to help you have the best sex of your life. Whether you're buying your first vibrator or your 10th leather flogger, you'll be assisted by a knowledgeable and friendly staff in an elegant, sex-positive environment. If you're looking to expand your sexual expertise, they offer free weekly workshops in locations nationwide where no subject is taboo or off-limits. Visit PleasureChest.com to learn more, because sex never goes out of style. You can use the coupon code Tristan at checkout and enjoy a free Pleasure Chest lube with every purchase. For years now, the Swedish-based designer brand Lilo has been at the forefront of pleasure product technology. Lilo's first product changed the way the adult industry thought about sex toy design upon its original release. With its sleek lines, its graceful shape, and its incredible performance, it was as much a piece of art as it was a pleasure product. Suddenly, Lilo had made it possible to perfectly blend form and function, and they continue to release groundbreaking products year after year. Since then, Lilo has only enhanced their reputation for quality and beauty, and now they lead the luxury industry thanks to a long heritage of innovation. Lilo is the hallmark of personal, intimate pleasure. Lilo is indulgent, sophisticated, elegant, and above all, intensely satisfying. Visit Lilo.com today to start exploring a new sensuality.
Ready to take your sex life to the next level? Let Tristan Taramino's award-winning Expert Guide Sex Education Series help. Each DVD is packed with honest information, explicit techniques, scorching sex scenes, authentic chemistry, and real female orgasms. Go to puckerup.com and use coupon code SEXOUTLOUD for 25% off your order.
You're tuned in to Sex Out Loud with your host, Tristan Taramino. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or comment, please send an email to Tristan at puckerup.com. That's Tristan at puckerup.com. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, everyone. Hey, I am pre-recording this particular show because I'm in San Jose at International Ms. Leather. And next weekend, I'm actually going to be in the current hometown of my guest. That's right. I'm going to be in Seattle, Washington, and I'm giving the keynote for the National Coalition for Sexual Freedom Presents the Consent Summit, which is an all-day summit all about consent. It's happening Saturday, April 23rd. And then on Sunday, the 24th, and Monday, the 25th, I'm headed to Portland, Oregon to teach two workshops at SheBop. So if you're interested in getting tickets for the Consent Summit, go to ncsfreedom.org. And tickets to my workshops, which have limited seating, go to sheboptheshop.com. Okay, so I've been talking to Matilda Bernstein Sycamore about her novel, her memoir, but it's a, sort of a trippy memoir, The End of San Francisco. And before the break, you talked about this opening scene with your dad. And I have to say, it was one of the most intense scenes of the entire story. Both because I feel like it definitely resonated for me, this idea that you're sort of surrounded by people who would really rather you not be emotional, feel anything, or say anything. that was my sense of the situation.
Absolutely.
Which is just, is a devastating experience that I've had. But my first thought as a reader was, maybe this is because you love direct action. I don't know. But I was like, whoa, you're not even going to ease me into this?
Totally. Yeah, I don't believe in making things easy for the reader. You know, I always want the reader to enter on the terms of the narrator, in this case, me, because I think that opens up the possibility for a more intimate experience. You know, I think as soon as we start explaining our lives, and justifying them, and then we lose the actual possibility for anyone to understand. And I know we're taught the opposite. We're taught, especially if we're not, you know, our lives are not what is considered the center, so straight, white, male, right? If we're anything other than that, then we're supposed to constantly be justifying our existence and, you know, talking about how did I even, you know, get to this, you know, dark, depraved, and desperate, and, you know, whatever sort of life, or even just why are we even alive, you know? And I think, for me, I always want the reader to enter, you know, in a different way, a way that is more, it's sort of suffused with all the layers at once.
Yeah, but and as you framed it before the break, it was interesting that moment actually, it did crack something open for you, right?
Exactly.
It made this book possible. So in that context, it's really interesting how these just significant life events, which, you know, all writers use as sort of a tipping point or a catalyst or a starting point, can really open the door to kind of other possibilities.
Absolutely.
So there are moments also as a reader that I often felt disoriented. And I'm wondering if this was intentional and how it wasn't a disconcerting. It wasn't a horrible feeling. I just sometimes felt like, where am I? What period of time am I in? What am I feeling? It was a very visceral experience for me.
Yeah, that's great. That's exactly my intention. You know, I didn't, especially between chapters, I didn't want, you know, each chapter is very self-contained in a way. And in some chapters, you know, within the chapter, you know, in the same paragraph, you might be in five different places, and I don't necessarily delineate them. Because I wanted to sort of show the way memory works. You know, I think in remembering things, you know, we think about one thing, and then suddenly we're somewhere else. And then we think about that thing, and we're somewhere else. And so if we impose a kind of clarity that doesn't actually exist in memory, I think we lose the actual experience of it. And I think also I wanted to, especially in some of the parts about San Francisco, I wanted to question my own memory even. So you find, like, I'm circling around something that I actually can't quite remember, and even calling people up on the phone and saying, what was this like? And then they say it, and then I put that in the book. And then, you know, I call someone else. And what was that like? You know, and I wanted also to sort of keep, one, to challenge even the notion that my memory, you know, the author of the book talking about my own experience, is, you know, 100% correct, and also to show that the way memory is formed by both experiences and relationships in the present day and the past. And to sort of show all of that at once.
I thought that was one of the most interesting pieces in the book, because it is your voice, it's your story, it's your memories, like you say. And then there are these moments of dialogue where you've actually gone back and asked people in your life to reflect on a particular time or an organizing effort or a relationship, and all of a sudden you are sort of interrupted and almost like fact-checked in a very interesting way. I mean, it's an interesting device, because it also kind of shows, it also reveals things about your relationships with these people that you sort of went back to and what their sense of what was going on was.
Yeah, exactly. That was my intention, totally. And especially when I'm talking about someone also, and I'm not quite sure, you know, wanting to sort of, you know, enter their opinion into the narrative in some form as well.
Yeah, it works really well. I think it worked really well. And so you talk about San Francisco as a real place, as a home, as the center of your culture and community. And it also is a metaphor. So what was San Francisco and what has it become?
Well, for me, when I was 19, you know, I moved to San Francisco from cross country, and I was trying to unlearn everything that had made me. And so I had gone to Brown University, and, you know, I had spent my whole life working towards that, you know, the sort of overachiever child, and I wanted to outdo my parents, basically so I could survive their violence. And when I was there, I realized, oh, I'm not going to undo anything. I'm just becoming them. You know, I'm becoming someone more successful with them than them, colder and more distant, and beating them on their terms. And that's just internalizing the violence. And I also learned a lot while I was there, but most of it was from doing activism against the university for, you know, race and class justice. So I went to San Francisco in search of other, you know, outsider queers and anarchists and outlaws and vegans and activists and freaks and everyone who was being pushed to the side and told they should disappear, creating a life for ourselves, you know. And I really did find that. I really found that, you know, and part of that was the culture, the moment of time, you know, which was the early 90s. But also, I think that can happen for anyone at any time, you know, if you make the right choices and find the right people. But I mean, I didn't even know I was an incest survivor. And all of my closest friends who I met ended up also being incest survivors. And then we had this, you know, amazing possibility to talk about everything that we had silenced in ourselves and had been silenced in ourselves. And so I think San Francisco is where I learned how to be an activist. It was where I learned how to be a faggot. It was where I learned how to create culture on my own terms. It was where I learned how to, you know, create family that wasn't predicated on, you know, dominant straight or gay cultures. And it was where I learned how to challenge everything and how to, you know, critically engage in a way that is holistic and actually takes apart everything in the dominant culture that is harming us and everything in our own cultures that we're creating to oppose the dominant culture that still harms us. And so that's what it was for me. And but it also was a place that, like, let me down the most, you know, over and over and over. And that was one of the things I wanted to look at in this book, is why did I keep believing in it? You know, I kept trying to create, and did, you know, culture and activism and relationships that, you know, were challenging everything that, you know, wanted me to die or disappear or anyone like me. But still also finding really horrifying ways that people betray one another. And so I think the thing, in a larger sense, you know, what has happened in San Francisco, the early 90s was sort of, it was the beginning of, or it's almost, the, it was at the beginning of one of the first big waves of recent gentrification in San Francisco. And so even when, you know, I was finding these other, you know, like queers and dropouts and incest survivors and, you know, freaks and, you know, sluts and whores, you know, to create our own culture and love one another and challenge the status quo, you know, it was, we were still aware, or I was definitely aware, that we were part of something that was changing, you know, San Francisco just at the beginning. I mean, we were paying like $250 for a room. Now you pay, you know, the same room, maybe you pay just for the room, you know, with five housemates, $1,200. And, but it was still, and so I think in the interim, you know, in the sort of in the mid-90s with the big dot-com boom, and then, you know, more recently, the sort of the next, like, tech boom, which is sort of obliterated. San Francisco, you know, for generations, it has been a place where the fringe congregates and where the center is redefined by the fringe, you know, and sexual outlaws and deviants and, you know, desperate, you know, activists and outsiders, and has always been a place for a long time, you know. But I think what's happened in the interim is all of those possibilities have been squeezed out, you know. And it doesn't mean, I still think there are possibilities in San Francisco for queerness that don't exist anywhere else. So it doesn't mean these things don't exist. It just means that the sort of large, San Francisco is the only place that I ever lived where there was a queer alternative to the status quo that was visible on a daily basis. You know, you could see people, there was a neighborhood. That's never existed in my experience in New York, for example, you know, like, and certainly not in Seattle and, you know, or Boston or you know, the other places that I've, Washington, D.C. And obviously those people exist in all these places, but there wasn't enough of a critical density to have, like, an oppositional culture that literally existed in everyday experience, you know, and people living outside of the mainstream consumerist world pretty much all the time. And I think those possibilities don't exist in the same way because it is so expensive and because it has become such a consumerist monoculture along the model of New York, but, you know, with a very specific technology-based, you know, people who just go, you know, they graduate from college and they get a, you know, $150,000 job and they move to San Francisco, and people that don't have any life experience other than privilege. And so now it's become a playground for those people, and all of the fringes and the possibilities, I think, have been whitewashed. But I do think there are still possibilities. But for me, the possibilities ended and I only really felt lost. And that's why I had to leave. It wasn't because I feel like we're living in the dominant colonial power in the world. No matter what time we're living in a horrible time. And our existence is predicated on, you know, oppression, violence, stolen resources, you know, around the world. And so, but we have to make something work anyway. We have to challenge that violence and create something else. So I never want to participate in this idea that there was something in San Francisco that can never exist now, you know, or any of these, you know, highly gentrified cities that a lot of us are living in, you know, because we need to make it happen anyway. But there have been shifts that have made San Francisco into a much more awful place, for sure.
Okay, we're going to take another break. Yeah, that's a lot to digest. So people start, just think about those ideas, because
yeah,
Matilda has a lot of big ideas. During the break, when you're listening to these great commercials, and when we come back, more about the end of San Francisco after the break. For years now, the Swedish-based designer brand Lilo has been at the forefront of pleasure product technology. Lilo's first product changed the way the adult industry thought about sex toy design upon its original release. With its sleek lines, its graceful shape, and its incredible performance, it was as much a piece of art as it was a pleasure product. Suddenly, Lilo had made it possible to perfectly blend form and function, and they continue to release groundbreaking products year after year. Since then, Lilo has only enhanced their reputation for quality and beauty, and now they lead the luxury industry thanks to a long heritage of innovation. Lilo is the hallmark of personal, intimate pleasure. Lilo is indulgent, sophisticated, elegant, and above all, intensely satisfying. Visit Lilo.com today to start exploring a new sensuality. Hey everyone, it's Tristan. Listen, there is nothing sexier than experience. Just ask the Pleasure Chest. As the oldest sex-positive boutique in America, this legendary establishment has made it their mission to provide sexual fulfillment to everyone, regardless of orientation, identity, or experience. With stores in New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago, as well as online, the Pleasure Chest wants to help you have the best sex of your life. Whether you're buying your first vibrator or your 10th leather flogger, you'll be assisted by a knowledgeable and friendly staff in an elegant, sex-positive environment. If you're looking to expand your sexual expertise, they offer free weekly workshops in locations nationwide where no subject is taboo or off-limits. Visit PleasureChest.com to learn more, because sex never goes out of style. You can use the coupon code Tristan at checkout and enjoy a free Pleasure Chest lube with every purchase.
The Internet's number one talk station. Number one talk station. VoiceAmerica.com.
You're tuned in to Sex Out Loud with your host, Tristan Taramino. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or comment, please send an email to Tristan@puckerup.com. That's Tristan@puckerup.com. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, everyone. I've been talking with Matilda Bernstein Sycamore. And what are you doing for your summer vacation? Let me tell you what I'm doing for mine. July 22nd to the 23rd, I'm going to be at Poly Dallas Millennium Presents, the second annual symposium on designer relationships in Dallas, Texas. Go to polydallasmillennium.com for more information. And then a few weeks later, August 4th and 5th, I'm going to be doing some pre-cons for Woodhull's Sexual Freedom Summit. So first, you've got to find out about the Sexual Freedom Summit. It's an amazing event, great speakers, great lineup. And I'm going to be doing my Sex Educator Bootcamp Level 2 and 3 before the conference begins. We will tweet out the links to how to register. So maybe I will see you there. Okay, Matilda. So one of the things that strikes me in this book, and you probably knew that I would want to talk about this, is the sex. There's a lot of love and intimacy. There's sex work. There's radical ideas about sex. But then sex also feels kind of elusive throughout it. Mm-hmm, it feels a little bit slippery, and it feels, you know, I can't wrap my head around it, and I don't feel like you've found a sort of a groove in that part of your life. Does that mean, like, ring true to you?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think one of the things that I wanted to investigate, and which I still am investigating personally, is I think I've reached, in some ways, certainly over the last, decade, approximately, what I think it's kind of like a dead end in my own sexuality. And so I think for me, we say that desire is what created our queerness. So I would say that is accurate in many ways. I mean, it's not the only thing, but it certainly is a central thing. And I feel like the hope that I have in queerness has not been actualized in my own sexuality. And I think part of that is, for so long, most of my sexuality, I think, in my life, has taken place in public sex environments. And I think the model that I relied on for a long time was having super close friends who I didn't really have sex with. I mean, sometimes occasionally it might happen, but mostly not. And then I would have sex in public sex environments, so, back rooms, parks, sex clubs, beaches, bathrooms, etc. And that was highly charged in the moment, and I felt like the two worked really well together, and that was sustaining for me for a long time. But what's happened, and then, of course, sex work, to make a living, which is how I supported myself for about 15 years. And I had this idea that when I stopped turning tricks, I was a hooker for so long that I think in the beginning, certainly sex work opened up the possibilities for me to inhabit my own body, for me to understand boundaries, for me to create them, for me to actually experience things that I wouldn't have experienced otherwise, for me to feel empowered. And even for me to feel sexual in everyday experience. So no matter what I was doing, to have a sense of desire in everyday experience. But after doing it for so long and being, most of the people who hired me were the exact people who all of my politics were organized against. Mm-hmm. And so the ways in which I had to tone down myself in order to sort of inhabit a kind of unquestioning masculinity, which was required, in order to be a hooker, it was so overwhelming that I thought when I stopped, I was like, I'm going to feel a sudden, excitement and vibrancy. And that didn't happen. And I actually felt more exhausted and more drained. I had been dealing with chronic health problems for a long time, so that's a whole other thing. But I think what's happened for me is that the limitations of these environments, public sex spaces that, require a certain kind of masculinity, require shutting off, require a lack of vibrancy, really. It's all about one particular thing, and I think it's sad because there should be something else. And I always, in some part of me, have this idea that I'm here, so I'm going to meet these wonderful people, but I've been trying that for so long, and it's not going to happen. I go to sex clubs here in Seattle, and, people come up to me, and they're like, why are you so happy? And I think about it, I'm like, why do they think I'm happy? Because I'm not happy. It's because I'm smiling and because I'm friendly and no one else is. No one. It's just not against the rules in gay male sexual spaces, which are the spaces that I inhabit. And I don't think that there are queer sexual spaces for male socialized faggots that really exist. There are queer sexual spaces that I could be in, and mostly the people that I would, where my desire is centered, for better or worse, would not be there, Right. And also the spaces, you know, there are clearly not as many of them and they're not as delineated. And I mean, in Seattle, for example, there's very little, but, so I don't know. So it's something that I've been actually the next book, not my next novel, which is called Sketch to See, which is done, but the next book I'm working on is basically about desire and its possibility / impossibility in my own particular life. Perhaps my goal is to get to the possibility, but of course it's circling around the impossibility. And so I think in writing The End of San Francisco, I wrote it in that particular moment. And so so I was circling around. And I think also, I think I was focused on this, wherever the feeling was strongest, you know, in these relationships. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't in the sexuality. I mean, sexuality, perhaps, but not in the desire in the actual sex. It was in the intimacy, in the, you know, act of creating worlds on our own, in the activism, in the creative imagining, but not so much in the sexuality, which always for me has taken place elsewhere. And I wish I could figure out a way to have it not be that way, but it has not happened yet.
Mm. Okay, well, I'm really looking forward to that next book then.
Oh, good. That,
yeah, I'm totally into it. Okay. So you are actually one of our generation's most savvy and outrageous writers and spokespersons. It says so on the cover of your book. So the next thing I want to do with you, if you will indulge me, is I want to do a kind of a lightning round on current events. Sure. Like I want to throw out the current event and I want you to give me one concise, short sentence, which is going to be highly tweetable, I'm sure. Raymond, take note. Raymond, who live tweets this. So I want to do that. Are you up for that?
Sure, let's do it.
Okay, so we're going to take another break so that you can prepare, although I'm not going to tell you the topic. So you actually can't prepare at all. I'm just bullshitting. But when we come back, lightning round current events with Matilda Bernstein Sycamore. Don't go anywhere. Hey everyone, it's Tristan. Listen, there is nothing sexier than experience. Just ask the Pleasure Chest. As the oldest sex-positive boutique in America, this legendary establishment has made it their mission to provide sexual fulfillment to everyone, regardless of orientation, identity, or experience. With stores in New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago, as well as online, The Pleasure Chest wants to help you have the best sex of your life. Whether you're buying your first vibrator or your 10th leather flogger, you'll be assisted by a knowledgeable and friendly staff in an elegant, sex-positive environment. If you're looking to expand your sexual expertise, they offer free weekly workshops in locations nationwide where no subject is taboo or off-limits. Visit PleasureChest.com to learn more. Because sex never goes out of style. You can use the coupon code Tristan at checkout and enjoy a free Pleasure Chest lube with every purchase. For years now, the Swedish-based designer brand Lilo has been at the forefront of pleasure product technology. Lilo's first product changed the way the adult industry thought about sex toy design upon its original release. With its sleek lines, its graceful shape, and its incredible performance, it was as much a piece of art as it was a pleasure product. Suddenly, Lilo had made it possible to perfectly blend form and function, and they continue to release groundbreaking products year after year. Since then, Lilo has only enhanced their reputation for quality and beauty, and now they lead the luxury industry thanks to a long heritage of innovation. Lilo is the hallmark of personal, intimate pleasure. Lilo is indulgent, sophisticated, elegant, and above all, intensely satisfying. Visit Lilo.com today to start exploring a new sensuality.
Ready to take your sex life to the next level? Let Tristan Taramino's award-winning expert guide sex education series help. Each DVD is packed with honest information, explicit techniques, scorching sex scenes, authentic chemistry, and real female orgasms. Go to puckerup.com and use coupon code SEXOUTLOUD for 25% off your order.
You're tuned in to Sex Out Loud with your host, Tristan Taramino. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or comment, please send an email to Tristan@puckerup.com. That's Tristan@puckerup.com. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to Sex Out Loud. I've been talking today with Matilda Bernstein Sycamore, the author of her newest book, The End of San Francisco. And you've always been a troublemaker and a rabble rouser and a great thinker, quite frankly. So I wanted to play this game that I invented just for you. I've never even done it.
Oh, just for me. Perfect.
No, I've never even done it on the show before, but I was like, something is calling me to do this. So the game, everyone, is I'm going to call out a current event or situation, and Matilda's going to give us one little chunk of insight, opinion, one sentence, brief, like to the point. Okay, you ready?
Yes.
I'm putting some time, some imaginary time on the imaginary clock. Okay. First, anti-trans bathroom legislation.
I think it's just the dying gasp of a right-wing fear of, desire and embodiment.
That's a good one. The presidential election.
Well, I'm hoping that it's not Mussolini, as in Trump, versus Machiavelli, as in Clinton. I am feeling hopeful about the possibility that Sanders will be the Democratic candidate.
Okay, the state of the LGBT rights movement.
It's tragic, it's sad, it's depressing, and honestly, debilitating.
A plus-size model on the cover of Sports Illustrated.
I don't care about Sports Illustrated.
Great. No, good. Great. RuPaul's Drag Race.
I've never seen it.
Wow. The quote media made up transgender tipping point.
Well, when people stop killing trans people just for existing in the world, then I'll imagine that there might be a tipping point.
Hashtag Black Lives Matter.
It's one of the most important movements of the moment and is always inspiring to me.
Your favorite vegan meal?
Right now I'm loving roasted tempeh with beets, fennel, and a millet casserole. And broccoli rabe with turnips.
That sounds delicious. I'll come over for that. Sure.
Perfect.
Great. And then finally, I wanted to get your take on, there was a gay and lesbian writers conference in New Orleans. It's really one of the last holdouts, and it's called Saints and Sinners. And I was following, let's just say, some people of the younger generation who were live tweeting a bunch of the sessions that they went to. And there seemed to be a great divide in terms of, I mean, she was reporting transphobia, misogyny, sexism, casual racism, all sorts of things from gays and lesbians kind of a different generation. Now, not all of them, like Dorothy Allison was there and she was like kicking ass and being her radical, amazing self. But some of the stuff coming out of there seemed really disturbing. And I'm just wondering how we're still there and why. That queers are like not getting, are still bashing other queers, essentially.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think it's about assimilation, you know, because there's been such a stranglehold on queer dreaming for so long. The only thing we're supposed to want is assimilation, which means straight privilege at any cost. So that means access to marriage, military service, child rearing, and maybe, you know, becoming a gay cop or, you know, dropping a bomb on some innocent people abroad and getting away with it. That is what the so-called LGBT movement is. And I think that has infiltrated everyone's thinking, you know, I think across generation, but, and I think also the generational aspect is, you know, older gays and lesbians who are holding on to the only, you know, sort of the kinds of privileges that they have, right? And so they're just using it to, like, oppress other queer people who are, you know, younger than them, and or older than them, or their next-door neighbors. But I really think it's because of this sort of assimilationist mindset, which says that the only thing that matters is access to privilege. If the only thing that matters is access to privilege, that means you can step on anyone, you can kill anyone, you can get away with anything as long as you get that privilege. And so that's the sort of gentrified mindset of so-called LGBT thinking, you know, and I think, which is, of course, centered around gay and lesbian people with power and privilege.
You know, and on that note, is you and I both came of age at this moment where identity politics was huge. And now it seems more and more, you know, there was this recent study done of people under 18 and they were asked what their sexual orientation was. And 50% of people identified as straight and 50% chose other. There were a lot of other options and they chose other options. So do you think identity politics is dead? Do you think it's still necessary? And do you think change actually has happened in our lifetime in terms of people's own sexual and gender fluidity?
I think identity politics, for me, identity is a starting point and not an end point. So the nightmare of identity politics is when identity becomes the end point. So that's how you can just have gay put on any oppressive system and that's considered progress. You know, gay cops, gay whatever, gay bombs, gay, you know, whatever they want to do. It's just that's identity as an end point. So for me, I think all of us, you know, there's something about us that we can use as a starting point. And for me, as a starting point means challenging the violence of the status quo and creating something else. It has to be both. It can't be just creating something else because that's a sort of like apolitical escapism. You know, it has to be both. And so, I mean, I think that statistic you mentioned in some ways is very encouraging. If only 50% of people identify as straight, that means that there is a possibility to become something else. Of course, we don't know what happens to these people in 10 years.
Right.
At least if they're thinking about it, that sounds wonderful. You know, I'm not sure. I think we're living in a really challenging moment because on the one hand, you know, certainly 25 years ago, like, transgender was not even a word in radical spaces. You know, it was like, it was occasionally used about very few people. And now it's absolutely central to any kind of queer organizing. And transgender, you know, in the most radical way, you know, which is, you know, thinking about undoing gender, challenging status quo violence, creating more options for everyone that are not predicated on fucking anyone over, you know, and I think, so I think that's encouraging in a way, but at the same time we see the sort of the so-called trans movement, which is a few national organizations following the same dead end as the gay movement, the same thing. It's just like single issue struggle never helps anyone except for the people with the most privilege. And I'm worried for that example that's just going to follow the same model. Like Caitlyn Jenner is not helping anyone except herself. So there's no hope to me, in that kind of dead end of visibility politics for only the most privileged people, and in that case, like a right-wing Republican, who now people are saying is like a central figure in the trans movement. The only movement that Caitlyn Jenner is interested in is movement into her bank account. And we should not be deluded into thinking that people with retrograde politics who happen to identify as a certain kind of gender or sexuality that might on some level be similar to ours are ever going to help us achieve anything of worth in this world. They are only going to further the violence. They are only going to make things worse. And so I think we're living in this moment where on the one hand, they're really challenging, vibrant, and inspirational, incisive possibilities. And on the other hand, there's an absolute, you know, clamp down on, you know, creative world making and thinking outside of, you know, the most dead end, dreary, basically just sad, you know, complacency.
And on that note, we're out of time. Wow, what a summary, though. You really packed a punch there at the end. Thank you so much for being on the show. I really, really appreciate it.
Thank you. It was so much fun. I really loved it.
Matilda Bernstein Sycamore is the author of the Lambda Literary Award-winning memoir, The End of San Francisco, published by City Lights. Find out more at matildabernsteinsycamore.com. Follow her on Twitter at mbsycamore. I want to thank the whole crew. You know who you are, Karen Dana, Raymond Johnson, Colton, Cooper Beckett, Matt, Michael, everyone at Voice America. We're going to wrap this up quick, but that gives you a lot to think about. And when you think about it, remember, take some time to talk about sex out loud.
That's a wrap on today's show. Go to voiceamerica.com to listen to this and other episodes on demand or as podcasts. And make sure you come back next Friday night at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 Pacific, for Sex Out Loud with Tristan Taramino on Voice America Variety.